wanted to, on behalf of the panel, express our gratitude to the law school and to its dean for all of their hard work and hospitality in helping our crew from Washington set this up. Thank the parties for schlepping here rather than Washington, D.C. I don't know if that's a plus or a minus. I assume a plus. And also especially to the marshals who have been with us for 2.5 days here now, too, and just take such good care of us. So thank you again to the dean and the law school. Our first case this morning is 18-1700, Board of Regents versus Boston Scientific Corporation. Mr. Shaw, whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. The question presented to the court is whether the state of Texas' sovereign right to choose where it adjudicates disputes has been abrogated or waived by its filing of a case in its own state, the state of Texas. And I think the place to start here is the status of the law before the patent venue statute was enacted. And in FMC...
Just because we're here at a law school and for our benefit as well, could you spend a couple minutes to just tell us how we got here and where we are in terms of the issue? I'd appreciate it very much.
Yes, Your Honor. The state of Texas, through the Board of Regents of the University of Texas, holds all patents for the 14 institutions of the University of Texas systems. They filed suit against three entities, Boston Scientific, Ethicon, and Medtronic in the Western District of Texas. It is undisputed that jurisdiction exists over Boston Scientific in the state of Texas. They have employees in the state of Texas. They sell infringing articles in the state of Texas. The state of Texas has personal jurisdiction uncontested. However, under the patent venue statute, Boston Scientific came in and said the patent venue statute basically deprives the state of Texas of their sovereign choice about resolving disputes within the state because you have to sue in the place where the defendant resides or has an established place of business.
So if it were not a state that were the patent holder here, it would be clear this would be kosher.
Absolutely.
They could move out to Delaware and that would be an appropriate
business. Absolutely. And in fact, under the logic that is being offered by my worthy adversary.
And if the Board of Regents is asserting its claims as a political arm of the state of Texas, correct?
Undisputed.
So it's standing in the shoes of the state of Texas.
It is the state of Texas. Okay. So under their theory, the Congress tomorrow could pass a patent venue statute that said all patent cases have to be heard in the District of Guam. And the state of Texas would have to go to Guam to enforce its patents. That's just ridiculous.
That's not a legal conclusion. That's probably just an observation. But if you were just a regular party, there's no dispute.
No dispute.
And there's at least one major Supreme Court case involving Puerto Rico here, but that was and the state prevailed. But in that case, the state was a defendant in the action. And so this is, as you will acknowledge, I'm sure, different because here the state is the plaintiff, correct?
Right. There's two sides to the sovereign coin. One is as it stated in FMC, Supreme Court case FMC versus South Carolina Port Authorities, dual sovereignty is a defining feature of our constitutional blueprint. And then if you take that dual sovereignty, as you go back to the original Judiciary Act, you go back to the Constitution.
What do you mean by dual sovereignty? Are you referring to the ability of the state to sue and also to defend?
No. Dual sovereignty is the idea that there are two sovereigns involved here. There's the union of all of our states. That's the federal government is one sovereign. But the states are their own individual sovereigns. And one of the ways that you kind of can understand that is you and I are all citizens of the United States, but each of us can only be a citizen of one state. So you choose which state you're going to be a citizen of. And that's why corporations choose which state they're going to be a citizen of. Individuals choose what state. So it's a dual sovereign system. And one of the things from the beginning of the Constitution, they said to protect the integrity of the sovereign, the dignity of the sovereign, only one court was given jurisdiction over disputes between states and non-residents of the state. That was the Supreme Court, and that's in Article 3. However, and then Ames is a really interesting case, the Ames case, which is cited in our brief. And it basically says under this dual sovereignty system, states, quote,
does the Constitution extend to the state and cover the state when the state seeks to act as a plaintiff as opposed to a defendant?
Absolutely, because the state, anything a state does, it does as a sovereign. So a state is not an individual. It's not a corporation. A state only acts as a sovereign. Even in, if you look at the Wyandotte case, if you look at, there's several cases that say even, or the College Savings Banks case, even when the state acts in the commercial sphere, it's acting as a sovereign. It always acts as a sovereign. And what the Ames case said, and I think it's important, you take FMC, it's dual sovereignty, then you take the Ames case, and it says, quote, states were left free to seek redress for their own grievances in any court that had requisite jurisdiction. No limits were set upon the powers of choice in this particular. So states have the choice. If they can get personal jurisdiction over a defendant, they can sue the defendant.
What about Regents of the University of California versus Lilly?
The Regents of the University of California is what I would call a bad lawyering case, and it should not be a case that is binding upon this case at all for several reasons. Number one.
But it's contrary to what you just
postulated. No, it is not, Your Honor. It is not, Your Honor. And the reason why it's not is because in that case, you had a multi-district litigation where some pretrial matters were handled by an MDL court. And that MDL court then, sua sponte, on its own, decided it was going to try the case instead of following the statute and sending the trial back to California. California did not object. They agreed to it. They should have immediately mandamused that court when it held on to the case. They should have mandamused that court and said, you can't do that. A, it violates the statute.
Is that the basis on which the case was decided?
Yes, it is. They waived their ability by not seeking mandamus of the judge to force him to take it back to California. And then the second thing they did is they went through the entire trial process. They agreed. They waived their argument by going through the entire trial process and waiting until appeal to complain that the case should have been sent back to California.
That may be so, but we said the 11th Amendment applies to suits against the state.
This isn't an 11th Amendment case.
Not suits by a state.
This is not an 11th Amendment case. This is a sovereignty case, and those are two different things. The 11th Amendment came about because of the Chisholm case, and that was a kind of a funny case if you read the history of it. Georgia actually passed a law saying that anybody who tried to enforce a judgment against Georgia taken in another state could be subject to being executed. And then they passed the 11th Amendment in response to that Chisholm case.
Can I just interrupt you for a minute and just say, I understand what you're saying to us here today is that you're distinguishing the Regents of the University of California case because you're not relying on the 11th Amendment. You're relying more generically just on state sovereignty.
We're relying on Ames, Wyandotte, and Georgia versus PRC. And the reason
and
why—
none of those cases involve the patent— Well, not a specific statute for patent venue, right?
They don't, but then you got to realize also, if you look at the Brunette case, venue is not jurisdiction. So you can't, venue statutes are not jurisdiction. And then you also look at the case, and I believe it's in my reply brief, is you look at the statute that enables the Supreme Court to pass rules on procedure like venue rules. And it says the Supreme Court is authorized to prescribe general rules of practice and procedure like venue, but those rules, according to the statute, quote, shall not abridge, enlarge, or modify any substantive right.
Where are you looking in your reply brief? Are you
at page 8. And so if you look at the statute that enables the Supreme Court to promulgate rules of procedure or rules of managing their court, they are not allowed to pass rules that abridge, enlarge, or modify any substantive right. And it's absolutely clear that the right of a sovereign to bring a case within its borders, if there's jurisdiction, personal jurisdiction, is a substantive right. Jurisdiction is a substantive right.
Can I just move you into sort of like the dual questions presented to us, the threshold question being whether we have jurisdiction and then reaching the merits? On the jurisdictional question, under collateral estoppel doctrine.
Collateral order.
I'm sorry, too long ago. Collateral order doctrine. The first criteria is that it needs to have conclusively determined the disputed question. Why is that not met here? Because you still have the ability to go back to Delaware, the Delaware court, and to move to retransfer the case.
That flies in the whole face of the concept of affront to the dignity. We don't have to do anything in Delaware. We're not consenting to the jurisdiction of the Delaware court. We're not agreeing. The state of Texas is not going to go to Delaware. As a matter of fact, if this
case— So you think requiring you to do that step in and of itself then merges with the merits question?
Correct. And again, take a look at Wyandotte. Wyandotte's the case for the state of Ohio filed in the Supreme Court against Michigan, some Michigan defendants and other defendants for polluting Lake Erie that flowed into Ohio. And what the court and the Supreme Court there declined jurisdiction over that case because they said you can sue in an Ohio court under the Ohio long-arm statute, and we'll look at it on appeal. But the reason why the Supreme Court declined jurisdiction is because they could sue in Ohio. Then you look at the Georgia versus PRC case where the Supreme Court had to accept jurisdiction. Why? Because Georgia could not get jurisdiction over all the defendants in Georgia. Georgia has the right to adjudicate the dispute in Georgia, and if they can't do it in Georgia, they could go to the Supreme Court. Ohio, they could decline jurisdiction in the Supreme Court because Ohio, under the long-arm statute, could bring it in Ohio. So that's the same thing. That shows that the sovereign has the right to bring the case in any court where the personal jurisdiction can be obtained.
Go to the third factor of the collateral order doctrine and be effectively unreviewable on appeal from a final judgment.
Right. The affront to our dignity of showing up in Delaware and litigating can't be undone. Once we go to Delaware and litigate—
How can you have an affront to the state's dignity if the state has chosen to step down and to compete toe-to-toe in the private sector?
College Savings Bank. College Savings Bank says you cannot have a coercive waiver where just because you are participating in a commercial activity that is somehow ipso facto a waiver of your ability to assert your sovereignty. So College Savings Banks blows that argument out, that there is no way that you can say that forcing us to go to Delaware to do anything when we don't consent to Delaware, we're not agreeing to Delaware, and it puts them in an untenable position too, because if we were in Delaware, we're not consenting to any compulsory counterclaims.
I understand your argument, and I accept that the state has sovereignty on suits that's brought against the state, but I'm not yet convinced that you can use that sovereignty now, which is a defense, and now turn it into a sword and go out in the private sector battlefield and have a right that your competitors don't.
Well, my competitors are not states. So states are different. I mean, fortunately or unfortunately, I've never met anybody who's faced a sovereign immunity or a sovereignty argument that said it was fair. Sovereignty is not meant to be fair. Sovereignty, the state occupies a place above other competitors in the marketplace, above citizens, above everything else. We're like the United States. We're a sovereign. And as a sovereign, we have a right. And again, Wyandotte, under the Constitutional and the Judiciary Act, states were left free to seek redress for their own grievances in any court that had the requisite jurisdiction. No limits were set on the powers of choice in this particular. No limits were set on the power of choice. Our choice is the Western District of Texas. There's personal jurisdiction
so
in the Western.
Just to get this off the table, when your citation, what you just said, when you say states or courts, rather, are we talking about state courts and federal courts or just state courts?
If there's personal jurisdiction, any court we want to be in, and we want to be in the Western District of Texas, personal jurisdiction is not, they don't disagree with it, they agree with it. And by the way, the only thing they're arguing, they're not arguing that Congress abrogated our sovereignty by doing this. They're not arguing that we consented to it. They're arguing that we waived it. We didn't waive it. As a matter of fact, if you look at—
Waived it how? By
simply filing a suit. But you can't waive sovereignty by filing a lawsuit. That's College Savings Bank. It's Hydro-Quebec. It's TEJIC, which I argued the TEJIC case before this court. And we only waive in compulsory counterclaims in the same form where we chose to file. That's the only that's TEJIC. So you'd have to overrule TEJIC, you'd have to overrule Ames, you'd have to overrule FMC, and you'd have to find something contrary to Wyandotte and Georgia PRC.
I have one more question, which is on the last element of the collateral order doctrine. Can you just walk me through what would happen if we were to say we didn't have jurisdiction and you were in Delaware? What would happen at the end of the Delaware suit? You could still complain about the order that transferred the case to Delaware.
Well, that's assuming the Supreme Court wouldn't hear our appeal of that decision, so we'd go to the Supreme Court. We wouldn't go to Delaware. And we go to the Supreme Court and say that that's an affront to our dignity, and there's actually—
Okay, so you do that. You go to the Supreme Court. Then what happens? And let's say, I just want for myself and for the students in the room to hear what it is that would happen at the end of the Delaware case.
Well, there's actually a Supreme Court case that says if we go to Delaware and we submit this to the – voluntarily go to Delaware, in other words, don't appeal to the Supreme Court and go to Delaware and let them decide the issue, we're stuck with what the Delaware court decides. That would be the result. But we wouldn't do that. We would go to the Supreme Court.
But why couldn't you also alternatively just dismiss it, move to dismiss in Delaware, get a final judgment and appeal it to us in that venue, in that –
Well, practically what would happen is we'd go file this case in the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court would have to take the case under the Georgia PRC case because we can't – if we can't get personal jurisdiction or we can't get the case heard because the venue statute has somehow been transformed into a jurisdictional statute, which it's not. So you would have to transform the venue statute into a jurisdictional statute. It's not. But if somehow that happened, we'd go file in the Supreme Court. And if the Supreme Court agreed that a venue statute is a jurisdictional statute, they'd have to take our case.
What would you take to the Supreme Court?
The patent case.
Our decision in that regard or the patent case itself? What procedurally?
Well, procedurally, we would go to the Supreme Court and say that you did not have the ability to make us go to Delaware.
So you would be appealing our decision.
Right. But if the Supreme Court disagreed with it and affirmed you, which I don't believe they would, but if they did affirm you, we would simply non-suit the case and go sue them in the Supreme Court. And under the Georgia versus PRC case, the Supreme Court has to take it. I don't think the Supreme Court's going to appreciate being forced to take every patent case filed by a sovereign because the patent venue statute has been magically transformed by the Federal Circuit into a jurisdictional statute.
Could you file the original suit in the Supreme Court?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
That is what you're talking about.
Yes. Yes. So if you transform a venue statute into a jurisdictional statute in violation of two Supreme Court cases, somehow venue becomes jurisdiction, which it's not, then every sovereign would be filing their patent cases in the Supreme Court because otherwise everybody's going to be every state is going to be forced to go to Delaware to enforce their rights. So this is an untenable situation. I'm over my time and
I appreciate that.
And I want to make sure I have a little time for rebuttal.
Sure. No, we'll reserve your
rebuttal. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court. In Lapides, the Supreme Court warned against the selective use of sovereign immunity to achieve litigation advantage. And that's exactly what the board and Tissuegen are trying to do here. But sovereign immunity is a shield.
What do you see as the difference between sovereignty and sovereign immunity?
So that's a good question because it certainly percolates through the briefing. Sovereign immunity, to be plain, was the basis on which the motion to dismiss was brought before the district court. There was no mention of this broader penumbra of sovereignty. And to the extent that sovereignty is what my adversary suggested, which is the right of a sovereign to choose the federal district court in which it brings a patent infringement suit, regardless of federal venue statutes, there's no support for that. But that, I submit, is the version of sovereignty that's being advocated and pressed for today. None of the cases that were mentioned, and I'm happy to walk through them by my adversary, suggest that sovereign immunity or sovereignty, a broader principle of constitutional sovereignty, confers on the state a right to home field advantage in federal court when it brings a patent infringement suit. There's absolutely no support for that proposition.
Does it have that advantage in state courts?
A patent infringement suit? So in state court, presumptively, a patent infringement suit would be preempted or not.
No,
we have exclusive jurisdiction.
General, not take okay. The patent suit out of it.
Yes, Your Honor. So in state court, based on Pennhurst, we have, I think it is arguable and probably correct that a state can waive its sovereign immunity in state court, but not in the federal courts. But here, we didn't have that situation. Here, instead, we had the board and Tissuegen invoking federal jurisdiction in the Western District of Texas and then making the argument that they could selectively invoke federal jurisdiction just in that venue, but not in any other venue. And that's not what the cases say. Eli Lilly is on point, and we can talk about that. When you invoke federal jurisdiction, whether by removal, as in the Lapides case, whether by intervention, whether by filing a complaint, you invoke federal jurisdiction and consent to it writ large, and you consent to the application of the federal rules. That was the point in Eli Lilly. So
Can I just ask you, on the threshold kind of question under the collateral order doctrine, is it your view that the only reason we don't go to the merits of this case now is because they still have the ability to go back to Delaware and ask for a retransfer? And two questions, sort of like, is that your view? And if that's so, that's kind of a ministerial thing. We're just saying, okay, we'll be back here 6 months from now, right?
Yes. So, Your Honor, technically, we believe an order to transfer is not a collateral order. That's what this court stated in FDIC versus Mako Bancorp. It said a transfer order is not a final judgment. It's interlocutory and not appealable. That said, there wasn't an issue of sovereignty at play in that case, so it's not exactly on point. We don't think Florida Aqueduct is exactly on point either, because that was a motion to dismiss. And the court really emphasized that the value of the 11th Amendment sovereign immunity, it was a defendant, the state
entity
there.
What is, though, exactly is your argument for why the three elements of the collateral order doctrine don't apply?
Well, we don't believe it's a final order. We don't
believe. Well, that it's not a final order, that's fine.
Yes.
But then what about conclusively determine the disputed question?
That's we don't believe element. It's done that either, because as has been suggested, the district currently presiding over this case hasn't weighed in on the issue.
So that was my question. Yeah. Are you saying that one thing, we can call it ministerial or whatever, that the only reason that that factor is not met is because they have to go back next week, go to the district court judge, and move to retransfer it back to Texas?
Or,
and then, but if they did that and the district court rejected that motion, then would they meet the collateral order doctrine, all the factors?
Well, I think, as I said, neither FDIC nor, because the motion to transfer was denied in that case as well, the U.S. entity, the FDIC, was transferred to a court it didn't want to be in. But that wasn't considered final. But again, I don't think the case is squarely on point. And to be candid, I think the collateral order issue is a little closer than the merits issues, because there is not a case specifically on point.
So just to come back to my original question,
yes,
which is maybe it's me, but can you answer the question that Judge Stoll and I both posed? Is your only reason why the conclusively determine the disputed question is not met is because they haven't gone back to Delaware, asked them to retransfer, and the court hasn't yet rejected it? So that if they did that, and next month wouldn't we be back here, and wouldn't the collateral order doctrine suggest that we do have jurisdiction?
So technically, yes, in part. It's arguable that they could also go to the District of Delaware and say, well, transfer to Massachusetts, transfer to Minnesota. Where this case is actually going to be tried hasn't been settled conclusively yet.
So if they go back to Delaware and Delaware says no, rejects the issue, the request to retransfer it, then we're done and there's no more defense under the law.
I would agree with that. But as I said, I think the
what
collateral...
What if they moved to dismiss?
Pardon?
If they just went over to Delaware tomorrow and said, we moved to dismiss.
They certainly could have done that. That was something that we raised at the threshold of this appeal, whether they should just voluntarily dismiss in Delaware. But that was a choice that they chose not to make.
So let's go on. Assuming we pass the collateral order doctrine and we're here on the merits.
Sure.
Okay, so now tell us where we are.
So the court recently addressed this similar questions in a similar context involving the University of Florida Research Foundation. This was just a very recent case. And in that case, the regents took the position that they waived sovereign immunity as to some issues, but not as to 101 issues. And the court said a state waives its 11th Amendment immunity when it consents to federal court jurisdiction by voluntarily appearing in federal court. Now, I recognize that in the briefs and just now we heard that it's not the 11th Amendment. It's just sovereignty. But the case law is very clear. When in Hans versus Louisiana, the Supreme Court said, well, sovereign immunity is broader than the 11th Amendment. What it meant is that the 11th Amendment explicitly applies only to suits brought against a state by citizens of another state. And in Hans versus Louisiana, the Supreme Court said, well, it also applies, because this was the common law, to suits brought against the state by citizens of that state. That's the distinction. It's not amorphous. It's not vague. It's not something we need to wonder about. There is no case standing for a broader principle that, as a sovereign, a state has a right to select a particular federal district court if it has personal jurisdiction and sue any entity there for patent infringement. There is no case for that. And
well,
Eli
there's
Lilly.
There's no case that affirmatively says that they can do it, but what's your best authority for why they can't?
Well, I think Eli Lilly is our best authority. And in that case, the Board of California made the same argument.
That just for clarification, is our opinion, not the Supreme Court's.
It is. It is your opinion. I think Lapides is very strong authority as well from the Supreme Court and consistent with this court, which is that by engaging, invoking federal jurisdiction, one consents to federal jurisdiction, and it's not in a specific venue. But
so
Eli Lilly.
That case hasn't been decided, that issue hasn't been decided by the Supreme Court.
I think it's odd only because such a radical breadth of sovereignty is being asserted by the board and by TissueGen here. I'm not sure anyone else quite has had the temerity to assert that kind of sovereignty. But in that case, the Board of Regents of California did. They said, well, we've waived our sovereign immunity, consented to sovereignty only in California, and you can't transfer us as part of MDL proceedings to Indiana. And there, the statute, the MDL statute there, it doesn't have an explicit provision as to states either, just like the venue statute for patent cases. And the Federal Circuit addressed this on the merits. It was not waived. The Federal Circuit did not say, well, you waive this by not contesting the consolidation for trial. And quite frankly, it's a jurisdictional issue. So it says the 11th Amendment applies to suits against a state, not suits by a state. That's the holding of Eli Lilly. And once you invoke federal jurisdiction, you're subject to the federal rules like the MDL transfer rule. That's the basis for that holding. It's not an issue that was waived. So college, I think there was some discussion of College Savings Bank being dispositive here. College Savings Bank is a completely different case in law and facts. It had to do with a plaintiff saying the state of Florida had essentially constructively waived its sovereign immunity by engaging in the sorts of activities that are regulated by the Lanham Act.
But
it was constructive waiver.
In that case.
Pardon me? It was the defendant as well. But what the court held, what Justice Scalia held for the majority, was that you can't just constructively waive by engaging in business activities. But he distinguished that kind of constructive waiver very clearly from active waiver by participation in litigation invoking federal jurisdiction. He said, that's real waiver. And that point was reiterated in Lapides' discussion of College Savings Bank. So College Savings Bank is really just not on point. A little bit about original jurisdiction. So I still don't fully grasp the argument, but this is what we know and we can agree on. Original jurisdiction is vested in the Supreme Court in cases involving a state. But the same clause, Section 2 of Article 3, says, but Congress can invest that original jurisdiction in the district courts. And that's what it did in Section 1331, Section 1338. That explicitly did that. Ames versus Kansas recognizes that. It said this case can go forward in the circuit court, the lower circuit court. The other original jurisdiction cases, Wyandotte versus Ohio, that was a case in which the court declined to exercise original jurisdiction, but venue was proper in Ohio. Actually, the case that's most helpful of these original jurisdiction cases, to the extent any of them are, is Georgia versus Pennsylvania Railroad, because as my adversary pointed out, in that case, Justice Douglas said, look, we should probably take this case against these 20 railroads because it's not clear that venue can properly be laid against all of them. So what's the implication of that? It means that in this case brought by a state, federal venue rules were going to prevail. And so in view of that, and in view of the importance of the case, original jurisdiction was accepted. So that means federal venue actually applies to that case. But there is, all of this is somewhat beside the point, because the board in Tishuden didn't seek to file suit in the Supreme Court. Could they have? I guess. The Supreme Court hasn't heard a jury trial since 1797, so I don't think it would have accepted it. But technically they could have, but they didn't. That's the only bearing of original jurisdiction in this case.
Can I just ask a question? I should know the answer.
Sure.
Assume it's somewhere, which is, what's going on in Delaware? Did somebody stay this case, and was it the Delaware court, or was it us?
Yes, Your Honor. So immediately after transfer, notice of appeal was taken. There were some initial submissions that were due before the district court. In those submissions, both parties said we thought the case should be stayed pending appeal, and then the district court did that. So a little bit on some of the other authority. Well, I have TEJIC, A123 Systems versus Hydro-Quebec, Biomedical Patent Management. These are the only cases that have been cited for the proposition that as a sovereign, a party has a right to select the venue that it's going to bring a patent infringement suit in federal court if there's personal jurisdiction. Every single one of those cases involve two separate actions. So there's a first action in which the sovereign arguably waives sovereign immunity, either by intervening or by bringing it as a declaratory judgment plaintiff. And then there's a second action in which it asserts sovereign immunity. And in each one of those cases, the court held, well, waiver in one action doesn't constitute waiver in a separate and second action. This is one action. The waiver occurred here. So the cases just don't apply. They don't apply at all. And it kind of makes sense. We wouldn't take the position that by waiving sovereignty in this case, in a case 3 years from now, if we brought a declaratory judgment action against the University of Texas, that sovereign immunity wouldn't apply because it had been waived in this case. I see my time
keep
is...
Going. Okay. Judge Rainey has another question.
Oh, sure.
My colleague Judge Stoll asked you to walk us through the application of the collateral order doctrine, and you got to the two steps. What about the third one?
Well, Your Honor, I would say that the board can raise these arguments on appeal, and it didn't. I guess
they're arguing that by the time we get to that point, to where the case is over and now we appeal on the merits, that the affront to the dignity of the state has already occurred.
Well, and that is their argument, and that's why this case exists somewhat between FDIC, which we've cited, which this court said an order transferring is not a collateral order, and Puerto Rico Aqueduct, where a court said forcing a state as a defendant to be forced into litigation through trial is a violation of sovereign immunity potentially and a collateral order. Here we have something in between. We have a plaintiff who's invoked federal jurisdiction with knowledge of the rules of venue, arguing that having to be forced to litigate this patent case is such an affront to our sovereignty in Delaware that it arises to the level of Puerto Rico Aqueduct.
But that
Aqueduct.
Kind of requires that we decide the merits. That gets into the merits question, right? So if it's not, it just seems to me that it would be odd to decline jurisdiction based on, we would almost have to decide the merits in order to decline jurisdiction. Am I missing something here?
Your Honor, so in preparing this for this argument, I certainly came to the conclusion that the collateral order is much closer, and there are certain issues of economy that would favor deciding it, and I see those. And
I appreciate that.
And I think that the merits are not close, and perhaps it would make the most sense just to clarify that at this point.
Well, are we making, I mean, the concern for this court would be, to take that step may not be of consequence to you all because you all end up in the same place.
Yeah.
But to us, we would be deciding that we have jurisdiction
yes.
to entertain these.
And that's,
do you see that as a leap if we were to do that? I mean, this wouldn't affect other patent cases and other venue disputes that we have, right? This would just, this could be singularly limited to this kind of issue, right?
It could be limited to this kind of issue, but as the court, I think, has experienced over the past year, issues of sovereignty being implicated by suits in which a university is bringing a patent infringement suit are coming up more and more. So could this come up in a different context? Perhaps.
But it wouldn't affect the run-of-the-mind patent cases.
No, it wouldn't affect
litigants and it, the venue issues we see for them. That wouldn't, it wouldn't open the door.
I think it would only affect those in which this sovereignty layer is imposed upon it, because I think that that is the real harm that is being posited by the board and by TissueGen here.
We raised, your view is that if you were to prevail on the merits, then it wouldn't, no doors would effectively be open because we've had a presidential opinion that would decide that question on the merits. So it wouldn't really matter, right?
I don't see the doors being opened sitting here or standing here today. I don't. I would agree that it's a very narrow issue. We raised it because it is jurisdictional, and we thought we should raise it as a threshold issue.
Thank you.
We'll
restore your 5 minutes if you need it.
Thank you, Your Honor. Their only argument below was waiver. That's the only thing they argued. Now they seem to be arguing abrogation, that the Supreme Court abrogated or Congress abrogated the state of Texas sovereign immunity by passing a patent venue statute that does not mention states. It does not mention immunity or sovereignty. There's no mention of states at all. And so it's impossible. And the only way that you can abrogate is through the 14th Amendment. The 14th Amendment is not implicated here. A venue statute, so in other words, to rule against us, a rule against the state of Texas, you'd have to find that a venue provision is substantive jurisdictional rights to defendants to only be sued where they reside as opposed to where there's jurisdiction over them. That is absolutely contrary to Brunette Machine Works versus Cockham Industries that says venue provisions do not confer substantive rights. It would also violate
that,
this.
Do you view that case as being the best case supporting your position?
Well, it's the Supreme Court case on point that says venue provisions do not confer substantive rights.
I understand
yes.
that.
And that's
I just was wondering if you viewed it as your best case supporting your position. So if your answer is yes.
Yes, it's directly on point. It's the Supreme Court, and they're trying to turn a venue provision into a substantive right to only be sued where they reside. And that would completely overturn all the 200 years of precedent that says a sovereign has the right to sue, a sovereign state has a right to sue a defendant in any court where the sovereign consents or waives, where there's personal jurisdiction over the defendant. It is undisputed we do not consent to Delaware. It is undisputed that we have not waived our sovereignty. That's why we're here. It is undisputed that we have jurisdiction over them in Texas. They don't dispute that. There is personal jurisdiction in Texas. So the question is, now I believe they're changing the game in the middle of the game and trying to say, well, wait a minute, the patent venue statute abrogated your sovereignty, and it did away with the Ames case that says we have an absolute unfettered right of choice to sue to protect the state's rights in any place where we can get jurisdiction. That's what Ames says. I quoted it to you. It also flies in the face of Wyandotte and Georgia PRC, where the Supreme Court said, I have to take the Georgia case. Why do I have to take the Georgia case? Because Georgia doesn't have personal jurisdiction in Georgia, in the court that Georgia wants to be in, over all the defendants. So we do have jurisdiction. Now, a different question may arise if one day the state of Texas or the state of Minnesota or any other state wants to sue someone for patent infringement where there is not personal jurisdiction. And then they would have to go to the Supreme Court, and then the Supreme Court can decide what they want to do, either take
so,
it.
So once the state files its suit, are you arguing that the rules of civil procedure don't apply to it as well?
Well, the rules of civil procedure, to the extent they don't violate the state's sovereignty, certainly apply. But the rules of civil procedure, to the extent they violate substantive rights, those rules would violate the statute that enabled the Supreme Court to pass the rules. I mean, I quoted the statute to you. The statute says that such rules, quote, shall not abridge, enlarge, or modify any substantive right. So the substantive right of a sovereign to choose a venue where it has personal jurisdiction over the defendant is a substantive right that the Supreme Court recognized in Ames, it recognized in Wyandotte, and it recognized in Georgia versus PRC. So for you to say that we can't do what we're trying to do, sue in the Western District of Texas, you would have to say that the choice of where a sovereign enforces its rights is not a substantive right. That is completely adverse to at least a half a dozen Supreme Court cases, but the one that is directly on point here is Ames. So unless you have further questions, we don't see this as a close case at all. And again, this is not an 11th Amendment issue. We are not – the only way the 11th Amendment would come into play is if once we were in court, they filed counterclaims against us. And so that's what makes it an untenable position, because if we have to go to Delaware and then they present counterclaims against us, then that would violate our sovereign immunity under the 11th Amendment. And then what do you do? You're in a weird situation of catch-22. This is not going to have major implications across the patent world. This only relates to a very limited situation where you have a sovereign holds a patent. The sovereign has the ability to exercise personal jurisdiction over a defendant who is infringing or conducting business within the state, and here that's undisputed. And the state or the sovereign chooses to file within its territorial borders. And remember, jurisdiction in our federal court system is territorial. And this is a jurisdictional question. We have the right as a state sovereign to submit to the jurisdiction of a court of our choice, and our choice is the Western District of Texas. We have personal jurisdiction. That should end the inquiry.
Thank you. I thank both sides and the cases submitted. It's a little bit of irony here that we're hearing this dispute at a law school, whereas I feel like maybe I need to go back to law school. So thank you.